Chapter 19. Eddie was leaning against the elevator's rear wall when the car reached the lobby. Max was to his right. When the doors opened, he pushed himself off the wall as two strangers in suits charged inside. Eddie thought nothing of this lapse in elevator etiquette as the men brushed against him. Then he felt one of them reach a hand into his coat pocket and start to lift the Beretta hanging in his shoulder holster. He turned to react, and a gun fitted with a silencer was pressed between his eyes. Max was just as quickly disarmed. It took all of 2 seconds. "Either of you move and you're dead," the larger of the two men said. His English was accented. The close quarters negated most of Seng's power martial arts moves, but that didn't mean he wasn't going to put up a fight. He tensed fractionally, and the gunman somehow sensed it. The pistol was rammed into Max's gut, expelling his breath in an explosive whoosh. "That is your last warning." The doors whispered closed and the elevator began to rise. As Max struggled to reinflate his lungs, thoughts swirled through Eddie's mind. He wondered how they had been tracked so easily and quickly, and if he should reveal that he suspected this was Zelimir Kovach, the man mentioned on the bug Juan had planted at the retreat. He also wondered why Kyle Hanley was so important to the responsivists that they would take a chance like this to get him back. It didn't make sense. "You're going to have to kill me," Max was finally able to say. "You're not getting your hands on my son again, Kovach." The Serb appeared surprised that Max knew his name, but the look quickly faded. He must have deduced they had heard the tape from the bug. Despite Kovach's thuggish appearance, Eddie realized he wasn't a stupid man. "That is the most likely outcome," Kovach agreed. "Not until you know who we are," Eddie said to himself, "and how much we've already learned." As bargaining chips went, it wasn't much. But it was better than nothing. If he was in Kovach's shoes, he would need to know how deeply the responsivists' security had been penetrated. How much time that would buy them depended on how they were interrogated. And what they could do with that time was a whole separate issue. He and Max were on their own. There would be no rescue, and the hotel staff had already been informed that their guests in the top floor suite weren't to be disturbed for any reason. By the time the elevator reached the 6th floor, Eddie had come to the depressing realization that Kovach had them boxed in. That meant he and Max had to split up if they wanted to get out of this alive. Max had been a hell of a warfighter in his day, and Eddie put him up there with the chairman when it came to cunning, but he wasn't physically up for an escape, and, with his son hanging in the balance, he wasn't there emotionally either. The elevator doors opened. Kovach and his silent partner stepped back, motioning with their weapons for Eddie and Max to precede them. The two corporation operatives exchanged a glance that conveyed their thinking had been on a parallel course and had come to the same conclusion. Just the tightening of Max's eyes and the barest of nods told Eddie that Max knew they had to make a break for it on their own, but that he wouldn't leave his son behind. Eddie saw Max's permission to go, as well as his acceptance of the consequences. They walked down the hallway to their suite. They paused at the door. Eddie considered attacking again. Kovach's lieutenant was close enough to kill with one blow, but the Serb was several paces away. It was clear he understood the dynamics of moving prisoners. "Using your left hand, remove your keycard," Kovach ordered. Again, Eddie understood that most right-handed people would put the key in their right pocket. It would be awkward reaching for it with the off hand. Eddie turned to partially face Kovach and said, "There is a special lock on the door. We can't get in." "I am familiar with such a device. You can still enter. Talk again and I shoot your left kneecap." Eddie jammed his left hand in his right pant pocket and fished out the electronic key card and used it. The insert light on the lock flicked from red to green, and he could turn the handle. "Step back," Kovach ordered. Eddie and Max did as ordered. Kovach's partner entered the suite. In just seconds, they heard Dr. Jenner cry out, What is the meaning of this? The gunman ignored him as he made the demand again. 20 seconds later, the partner shouted out to Kovach in clear American English, "Sweet, secure. Only the deep programmer and the kid." Kovach flicked the gun barrel, and Max and Eddie entered the room. The Serb inspected the lock Jenner had placed around the doorknob and smartly didn't let the door swing closed. Dad? Kyle Hanley stood from the sofa, looking none the worse for the drugs that had been coursing through his veins for the past 24 hours. Kyle. How dare you do this to me? Kyle shouted. I did it because I love you, Max said helplessly, conflicting emotions wrenching his words. Silence! Kovach roared. He strode up to Jenner, towering over him. Jenner seemed to shrink into his skin, and his latest protest died on his lips. When the Serb assassin spoke, his rage was barely contained. Mr. Severance gave me express orders not to kill you, but he didn't say anything about this. He slammed the butt of his pistol into the psychiatrist's head. Two things happened at that instant. Jenner started to collapse to the floor, the wound pumping blood, and Eddie Seng took off running, using the momentary distraction to its fullest. The French doors leading to the balcony were 10 paces away, and he'd covered 3/4 of that distance before anyone knew he was moving. Max instinctively shifted a foot to the right to block the second gunman's aim, while Kovach continued to gloat over the collapsing shrink. Eddie hit the doors at a full run, hunching his shoulders at the last second as he burst through the delicate wood mullions and antique panes of bevel-cut glass. Shards ripped at his skin as a bullet whizzed by, striking the building opposite in a puff of brick dust. He barely slowed as he reached the railing. Using just his legs, he vaulted over it and twisted around in midair so that he was facing the building as he started to fall. He grabbed 2 of the countless wrought iron spindles, his hands slick enough with sweat to allow him to slide down smoothly, while 70 feet of nothingness separated him from the traffic crawling below. His hands smashed into the concrete deck just as the tips of his toes touched the 5th-floor balcony railing. Without a moment's hesitation, he let go and stepped back, falling all over again in a headlong plunge toward the sidewalk. As the 5th-floor balcony whipped by his face, he reached out and clutched 2 of the wrought iron bars again, slowing himself just enough so that he was in constant control of his descent. It was an awesome display of strength, balance, and a total lack of fear. He was teetering on the 4th-floor railing, centering himself for the next plummet by the time Kovach reached the suite's balcony. At first, expecting to see Eddie's corpse sprawled on the asphalt, Kovach didn't spot Seng until he stepped back from the baluster below. The Serb opened fire, raining down a storm of bullets. Eddie felt the shots ripple the air around him as he slid down the spindles. His hands slammed into the concrete. No matter how he stretched his body, he couldn't quite reach the next balcony down. His wrists were screaming with the strain, so he let go, falling just an inch before he found purchase. He windmilled his arms for a second before dropping again. If his hands weren't broken by the time he reached street level, he'd consider it a miracle. Kovach couldn't get an angle, and rather than risk being spotted by passers-by who were starting to gawk at Eddie's insane stunt, Kovach holstered his pistol and stepped back into the suite. For a moment, Eddie considered leaping onto the balcony and entering the 3rd-floor room, but he had no idea how many men Kovach had covering the building. His best chance was to get away as quickly and cleanly as he could and regroup later. He stepped back again, smearing skin off his now dry palms as he slid down the spindles. The 2nd-floor balcony was a story and a half above the pavement to allow for a high ceiling in the hotel's lobby. The drop was nearly 20 feet. Just off to Eddie's left was a bright yellow canopy arching out over the sidewalk to protect the entrance from the elements. Like a tightrope walker, he padded across the top of the railing and dove for the canopy, torquing his body so his back slammed into the stiffened fabric. Sliding down its curved face, he was able to reach between his legs and grab onto the underlying metal frame. He somersaulted over the edge, holding on as tightly as his damaged hands would allow, and dangled for a second before nimbly dropping to the ground. A few in the gathered crowd cheered, not understanding what was happening. Eddie started running down the sidewalk, dodging through the throngs as best he could. The noise of a powerful engine roared over the din of regular commuter traffic. He whirled to see a black motorcycle jump the curb and start after him, panicked people scattering out of its path as the rider hit the throttle hard. Less than 15 feet separated him from the bike, and the big Ducati was accelerating. Making like he was running for the entrance of the bookstore next to the hotel, Eddie leapt to his left instead, flying onto the hood of a parked car. His momentum slid him across the vehicle and dumped him in the road just ahead of a Volvo truck that had found a little room in the congestion to speed up. The driver never saw Eddie fly over the car, so he kept on the gas. Eddie had a second at most to twist out of the way of the heavy-duty tires. He covered his head in a vain attempt to protect it as the 10-wheeler rolled over him. Heat from the engine was like the open door of a blast furnace on his back. The truck suddenly braked, wheels skidding on the asphalt. Eddie heard the bike again. It must have returned to the road between two parked cars right in front of the Volvo. He scrambled from underneath the vehicle. An open-topped, double-decker tourist bus was in the opposite lane. It had paused to let people off. Eddie was near the rear of the vehicle, far enough away from the driver that he most likely wouldn't be noticed. He jumped hard at the side of the bus, thrusting upward to get himself off of the roadway. He kicked out with his other foot, connecting with the truck, still idling 3 feet away, gaining himself another foot. He did this again and again, kicking each vehicle in turn, ignoring the startled faces of passengers in the bus as he used his strength and dexterity to shimmy up the gap between the two trucks until he reached the top of the Volvo. He rolled onto its roof, panting, and would have paused to catch his breath, except a sizzling hole appeared inches from his face. He looked up. Kovac was on the balcony again, taking deliberate aim. With little chance of alerting pedestrians with the shots, he could take his time. Eddie jumped to his feet, running along the top of the truck, and leapt for the bus as it started to pull away. He sailed over a bench seat of Japanese tourists and tumbled into the aisle. He ran to the back of the bus to see the Ducati pull out from in front of the Volvo truck and start after him. Eddie might have made it clear of the hotel, but he hadn't escaped yet. The motorcyclist in black leathers stayed right behind the bus, making no attempt to hide the fact he was following it. Eddie didn't know if the man had a radio tucked into his helmet. If he was running the operation, he'd make sure all team members stayed in constant communication, which meant the guy on the bike would have reinforcements soon. And since Kovac must have a detailed report on the hostage rescue team that had snatched Kyle Hanley, he would most likely bring a large force to get Hanley back. The bus pulled out onto a 4-lane road, picking up speed as it approached the Colosseum. Cars zipped by, horns blared, and the occasional rude gesture was thrown out the window by their drivers. The Ducati rode in its wake like a manta ray following a whale. Eddie flexed his fingers to work some blood back into them as he thought of a way out of this mess. He'd left his cell phone in the suite because Max had been carrying his. A crazy idea popped into his head, and if he hadn't felt he was running out of time, he would have dismissed it entirely, but he was getting desperate. A set of spiral stairs at the rear of the bus led Eddie down to the first level. He was relieved that there weren't many tourists taking this part of the trip. There had been only 15 people upstairs and just a handful were downstairs. No one paid him any attention as he strode down the aisle. Eddie kept in a crouch as he approached the driver. There was a translator sitting in the front seat, working on her nails with an emery board between her canned speeches from the tour script. Seeing Eddie approach, she set aside her file and smiled brightly. Judging by his appearance, she assumed he was part of her group and asked him something in Japanese. He ignored her entirely. The driver wore a white shirt, black tie, and a cap more befitting an airline pilot. Eddie was just thankful he had a slender build. In one motion, Eddie grabbed the driver's right arm and heaved him out of his seat. Seng ducked as the man rolled across his shoulder and then straightened quickly, hurling the driver down the couple of steps near the bus's main door. He hit the door upside down and collapsed in an untidy heap. The big diesel barely slowed before Eddie was in the driver's seat, his foot on the gas pedal. The tour guide was screaming, and passengers farther back began to look frightened. Watching the big wing mirrors, Eddie hit the brakes. Horns immediately erupted all around, and the Ducati shot from around the back of the bus, narrowly avoiding the car that rear-ended the double-decker. The guide wailed at the impact. The bike was hugging the center line, riding the gap between traffic, and Eddie let him travel halfway down the bus's length before hitting the gas again and swerving left. The bike had nowhere to go. The other lane was bumper to bumper. Had he hung back near the rear of the bus, he might have been able to tuck back behind it again, but he had committed himself to the gap. He dropped a gear and wrenched the throttle. The front wheel leapt off the tarmac as the 1,000cc engine shrieked, the rider bending low over the handlebars to reduce air friction and give him a fraction more speed. He never stood a chance. The bus clipped him 10 feet shy of where Eddie was sitting. The Ducati careened into a car in the left lane. The rider was launched over the front of his bike. Limbs flailing, he smashed head first into the rear window of the next car in the line of traffic. The safety glass turned into a glittering explosion of diamond chips. Eddie could only hope the helmet saved his life. The collision started a chain reaction of minor accidents behind him that quickly engulfed all four lanes. Eddie stopped the bus and hit the controls that opened the door. It swung only partially inward, blocked by the unconscious form of the driver. As the adrenaline surge that had sustained Eddie over the past frightening minutes began to ebb, he thought of the chairman and how he always made some sort of joke at a time like this. It wasn't Seng's style. "Sorry," he said to the tour guide, and pushed his way out the door. He looked back at the accident. The road was blocked from curb to curb with damaged cars. Drivers were out of their vehicles now, shouting and gesturing as only Italians can. He was about to turn onto a side street when a sedan smashed through the wreckage like a charging battle tank. Two men dove out of the way as their cars were crushed up against other vehicles. The sedan barely slowed, its front end mangled and its driver and passenger invisible for a moment behind their inflated airbags. Eddie knew they were coming for him. He ran back onto the bus, clipping the slowly rising driver behind the ear to keep him down. The pretty tour guide screamed when she saw him jump into the driver's seat again, jabbering at him in Italian so fast that the words blended into one long, continuous sound. He slammed the automatic transmission into gear. The bus took off with a lurch that sent the few passengers who'd gotten out of their seats sprawling. Cranking the wheel one-handed to keep the bus on the road ringing the Colosseum, Eddie grabbed the PA system microphone dangling over his right shoulder. He shouted, "Everybody, upstairs, now!" The handful of terrified tourists rushed to the rear of the bus, jamming the stairs in their effort to follow his order. Eddie kept his eye on the rearview mirror as the red sedan, a Fiat Bravo, he thought, bulled its way through the congestion in pursuit. It roared up alongside the bus. Eddie could see three men inside. The front passenger's hands were below the door sill, but he spotted a weapon cradled in the arms of the man in the rear seat. The man in back thrust the barrel of an assault rifle through the window and sprayed the side of the bus. Glass exploded as the rounds found their mark, and seat stuffing was blown into the air like confetti. Eddie swerved into the car, forcing it back once again while the shrieks of the passengers upstairs grew to a fevered pitch. Turning even tighter to avoid a stalled lane of traffic, Eddie felt the bus go light on its inside wheels as centrifugal force made the vehicle want to roll over. He edged the steering wheel slightly and the heavy bus mashed back down on its suspension, rocking precariously. The road straightened out as they completed their sweep around the Colosseum and headed northeast. On either side of the road, the new blended with the ancient as they raced past office blocks, churches, and ruined temples. The Fiat tried to pass the bus again, and Eddie swerved, feeling the satisfying crunch of metal. Accelerating past 50 miles per hour, Eddie thought that he had damaged the sedan more than he'd thought, because they didn't try to pass him again. That's when he heard the hammering crack of an automatic rifle. Despite the bus's size, he could feel the weight of shots through the chassis. They were firing at the engine in the rear, hoping to disable the vehicle and gun Eddie down at their leisure. Ahead, Eddie could see what he could only describe as a giant wedding cake. The building was massive, constructed entirely of marble, and seemed to loom over the area. He dimly recalled from somewhere that this was the monument to Victor Emmanuel II, the ruler who united all the Italian states into the modern nation it was today. The pomposity of the architecture was made worse by the sheer size of the building, its columns and steps making it look more like an enormous set of dentures than a memorial to a great leader. The road swept around to the left, revealing a huge bronze statue of Victor on horseback. With the sun beginning to set, tourists and backpackers still lounged on the marble steps, sipping drinks sold by vendors from carts. Another barrage pummeled the back of the bus, and the tourists outside started to scatter like startled birds. Eddie knew it was only a matter of time before they hit something critical or that he'd run into a police roadblock. The distant sound of sirens blaring was drawing closer by the second. A sign said he was on the Via dei Fori Imperiali, not that it meant anything to him. The road was broad by Roman standards and too open for Eddie's tastes. It divided ahead, next to an open parking area filled with buses much like the one he'd commandeered. He veered left down a street hemmed in by 4- and 5-story brick buildings. The storefronts offered everything from leather goods to electronics to exotic pets. But it was still too wide for what Eddie had in mind. Brake lights suddenly flared in front of the bus as traffic came to a crawl. Eddie pounded on the horn and he steered the bus onto the curb. The sidewalk wasn't nearly wide enough for the large vehicle. As he made his way down the cobbled walkway, the bus mowed down parking meters like wheat before a combine and shouldered aside automobiles amid a cacophony of car alarms and shouts. The bus plowed through the outside displays of a tourist shop, sending up a blizzard of brightly colored postcards and what Eddie thought, for one terrifying moment, was the body of a woman, but it turned out to be a mannequin displaying a T-shirt. The right side mirror was ripped off when the bus scraped against a building. He burst out onto an intersection. Cars screeched all around him as Eddie guided the bus toward a narrow lane that was more of a trench cut between buildings than a road. There were cars going into the alley, but not emerging from it. Kovacs's men fired at the bus again, having replaced spent magazines. The gas pedal suddenly felt mushy under Eddie's foot, and in the undamaged left side mirror he could see smoke erupting from the back of the bus. "Come on, baby, 50 more yards." The engine coughed and caught again and again, sputtering and surging in its death throes. Eddie reached for the microphone as the gap between the buildings grew closer, but not larger. "Everybody, brace yourselves!" Eddie sensed the engine about to let go, so he slipped the transmission into neutral and coasted the last 30 feet. Behind him, he heard the motor seize in a tearing of metal that would have lanced Max's engineer heart. The bus entered the dim alley with barely 5 inches of clearance on either side. The remaining left mirror was sheared off. Eddie saw that the road constricted even further just ahead, because one apartment building was slightly larger than its neighbors. He hit the brakes an instant before the bus struck the building, bounced back, and smeared against the opposite apartments, before becoming completely jammed. The impact caused a fresh wave of frightened screams from above, but Eddie could tell by how quickly the sound faded that no one had been hurt. A large red fire extinguisher was clipped just below his legs. He popped it free and smashed it into the windshield. The glass starred, but didn't break. He hit the windshield again and again until he'd opened a man-size hole. He jumped through it, setting a hand on the warm asphalt when he landed to steady himself before taking off at a run. When he looked back, he could see dense smoke boiling from behind the bus. Kovacs' men couldn't climb over the vehicle, so they would have to backtrack around the apartment block, provided they weren't boxed in by other cars who'd followed them into the alley. He rounded the corner and slowed to a normal pedestrian gait, blending in with the flow of people headed home from their offices or out to dinner with their families. A minute later, he heard car tires screeching as he ducked into a taxi. The cab pulled away as the Fiat Bravo braked in front of the alley. He'd lost them. A few minutes later, he threw some euros at the driver and jumped out of the vehicle while it was stalled in traffic. He bought a prepaid disposable cell phone from a tobacco stand. Eddie walked into a crowded bar, ordered a beer from the girl behind the counter, and dialed the hotel. The staff was still buzzing about the man who'd climbed down the balconies, so it took him a few minutes to explain that gunmen had broken into his room. The reception desk staffer promised to call the polizia. Eddie gave him his cell number. 15 minutes later, Eddie's beer gone, his phone chirped. "Mr. Kwan?" That was the alias they'd used to book the suite. "Yes. Our desk manager entered your room with the police. There was a man in your suite named Jenner with a cut to the head," the clerk said apologetically. "They would like you to return here to get your information. A statement, I think you call it. They have many questions about what took place and about an incident that happened nearby." "Of course, I'll be happy to cooperate with the authorities. I'll be there in 20 minutes. "Thank you, Mr. Kwan." "Thank you." Eddie dialed another number. When it was answered, he said without preamble, "Tiny, file a flight plan out of the country. I'll be there as quickly as I can." He didn't wait for the pilot's reply before cutting the connection and dialing again. As he listened to the ringing over the line, he knew that there was no way Kovacs would remain in the city, or in Italy for that matter, so there was no reason for him to wait around for the police to pick him up. "Hello? Chairman, it's Eddie. Kovacs has kidnapped Max." A heartbeat passed before Juan responded. "What about his son, Kyle?" "I think the little punk was in on it."